conjoined twins Chang and Eng Bunker, each of whom not only married but had 10 children, which sparks several additional lines of questioning. Gossip is popular because we know a lot about some people, but there's some information that we lack. We don't gossip about passing acquaintances. Celebrity gossip is particularly tantalizing. We have a sense of who Tiger Woods and Julia Roberts are, but we crave the missing pieces, their quirks, their romantic struggles, their secret vices. Curiosity comes from gaps in our knowledge. But what if there's not much knowledge there to begin with? In the 1960s, an upstart television network, American Broadcasting Corporation, signed a contract to televise NCAA football games. College sports is a classic insider's topic. With the exception of a fringe of die-hard sports junkies, most fans usually care only about their own school's teams. But ABC could show only a few games each week in each region. For ABC's bet to pay off, it needed to make viewers care about games that didn't involve their home teams. How do you go about making viewers in College Station, Texas, care about the Michigan versus Ohio State matchup? A 29-year-old named Rune Arledge, whose previous responsibilities primarily involved assigning crews to cover baseball, boxing, and football games, wrote a memo suggesting ways to improve the coverage of college football games. Arledge saw ample room for improvement. Sportscasters typically set up their cameras, focused on the field, and waited for something to happen in front of them. They ignored everything else, the fans, the color, the pageantry. It was like looking out on the Grand Canyon through a peephole in a door, Arledge said. One Saturday afternoon, after procrastinating all morning, he sat down to type out a proposal to his bosses. Heretofore, television has done a remarkable job of bringing the game to the viewer. Now we are going to take the viewer to the game. After our opening commercial billboards, instead of dissolving to the usual pan of shots of the field, we will have pre-shot film of the campus and the stadium so we can orient the viewer. He must know that he is in Columbus, Ohio, where the town is football mad, or that he is part of a small but wildly enthusiastic crowd in Corvallis, Oregon. He must know what the surrounding country and campus look like. How many other people are watching this game with him? How the people dress at football games in this part of the country, and what the game means to the two schools involved. The memo was 3 pages long. It discussed camera angles, impact shots, opening graphics. The heart of the memo, though, was a new way of engaging viewers who might not ordinarily care about a college game in Corvallis, Oregon. The trick, Arledge said, was to give people enough context about the game so that they'd start to care. Other people at ABC were excited by what Arledge had written. 2 days later, he was asked, at age 29, with a skimpy resume, to produce a college football game using the guidelines in his memo. Arledge intuitively made use of Loewenstein's gap theory. How do you get people interested in a topic? You point out a gap in their knowledge. But what if they lack so much knowledge about, say, the Georgia Bulldogs, that they've got more of an abyss than a gap? In that case, you have to fill in enough knowledge to make the abyss into a gap. Arledge set the scene, showed the local fans, panned across the campus. He talked up the emotions, the rivalries, the histories. By the time the game started, some viewers had begun to care who won. Others were riveted. Arledge's next assignment was to take over a series that was eventually renamed Wide World of Sports. The show introduced Americans to a variety of sports events they may never have seen before. The Tour de France, the Le Mans auto races, rodeo championships, ski races, and soccer matches. In covering these events, Arledge used the same philosophy he'd pioneered for the NCAA. Set the context and give people enough backstory that they start to care about the gaps in their knowledge. Who's going to falter during the grueling 24-hour Le Mans? Will the teacher-turned-barrel racer win the championship? What the heck is a yellow card? Arledge died in 2002. During his career, he became the head of ABC Sports and later ABC News. He founded the Wide World of Sports, Monday Night Football, 2020, and Nightline. He won 36 Emmys. The toolkit he developed for NCAA football stood the test of time. The way to get people to care is to provide context. Today, that seems obvious, because these techniques have become ubiquitous. But this avalanche of context started because a 29-year-old wrote a memo about how to make college football more interesting. Many teachers use some version of the Arledge toolkit to prime their students' interest. Some label the strategy advanced organizers. The idea is that to engage students in a new topic, you should start by highlighting some things they already know. An earth science teacher might ask her students to bring in pictures of an earthquake's devastation as a way of leading up to a discussion of plate tectonics. Alternatively, the teacher can set the context, a la Arledge, so that students start to become interested. A chemistry teacher might lead into the periodic table of elements by discussing Mendeleev and his long, passionate quest to organize the elements. In this way, the periodic table emerges from within the context of a sort of detective story. Knowledge gaps create interest. But to prove that the knowledge gaps exist, it may be necessary to highlight some knowledge first. Here's what you know. Now here's what you're missing. Alternatively, you can set context so people care what comes next. It's no accident that mystery novelists and crossword puzzle writers give us clues. When we feel that we're close to the solution of a puzzle, curiosity takes over and propels us to the finish. Treasure maps, as shown in the movies, are vague. They show a few key landmarks and a big X where the treasure is. Usually, the adventurer knows just enough to find the first landmark, which becomes the first step in a long journey toward the treasure. If treasure maps were produced on MapQuest.com with door-to-door directions, it would kill the adventure movie genre. There is value in sequencing information, not dumping a stack of information on someone at once, but dropping a clue, then another clue, then another. This method of communication resembles flirting more than lecturing. Unexpected ideas, by opening a knowledge gap, tease and flirt. They mark a big red X on something that needs to be discovered, but don't necessarily tell you how to get there. And, as we'll see, a red X of spectacular size can end up driving the actions of thousands of people for many years. Walking on the moon and radios in pockets. In the rubble of Tokyo after World War II, a young company, later named Sony, struggled to stay in business. It attracted a handful of smart scientists and engineers, but its first innovation, an electric rice cooker, was a failure. Initially, Sony survived by repairing shortwave radios. Around this time, Masaru Ibuka, Sony's lead technologist, became intrigued by transistors, which had recently been invented by a team at Bell Laboratories. Ibuka craved a substantial project to motivate his team of 50 scientists and engineers, and he saw tremendous promise in transistors. But when he bid to license the technology from Bell Labs, the Japanese Ministry of Trade and Industry denied the license. It was skeptical of the young company's ability to manage such a cutting-edge technology. In 1953, Ibuka secured permission to license transistors. He had a vision for a radio that would be based on transistors. The advantage of a transistor radio was obvious to engineers. It would free radios from the big vacuum tubes that made them so bulky and unreliable. Bell Labs told Ibuka that it didn't think a transistor radio was possible. His engineers began to pursue the vision anyway. Let's pause here for a moment to put ourselves in Ibuka's shoes. Your company has been struggling, and you've got a team of brilliant people whom you need to inspire. You have the potential to lead them in 100 different directions. Rice cookers, or radios, or telephones, or whatever else R&D could dream up. But you're convinced that the idea of a transistor-based radio is the most promising path. Your core message, then, is the dream of a transistor radio. How do you make this message unexpected? How do you engage the curiosity and interest of your team? The concept of a transistor radio is probably not enough in and of itself to motivate your team. It's focused more on technology than on value. A transistor radio. So what? What about tapping into some of the classic managerial themes? Competition. Sony will beat Bell Labs in making a transistor radio work. Quality. Sony will be the world's most respected manufacturer of radios. Innovation. Sony will create the most advanced radios in the world. Here's the idea Ibuka proposed to his team. A pocketable radio. It's hard in retrospect to comprehend the hubris of that idea. How utterly unexpected, how preposterous it must have seemed the first time a Sony engineer heard it. Radios were not things you put into your pocket, they were pieces of furniture. At the time, radio factories employed full-time cabinet makers. Furthermore, the idea that an upstart Japanese company would deliver such an innovation, when the brilliant minds at Bell Labs thought it impossible, was not credible. After all, the 1950s were a decade when made in Japan was synonymous with shoddy workmanship. But Sony engineers were talented and hungry. Ibuka's idea of a pocketable radio caught on internally and drove Sony through an incredible period of growth. By 1957, Sony had grown to 1,200 employees. In March 1957, just 4 years after Sony was grudgingly granted permission to tinker with transistors, the company released the TR-55, the world's first pocketable transistor radio. The TR-55 sold 1.5 million units and put Sony on the world map. A pocketable radio. Isn't this simply a brilliant product idea rather than a brilliant sticky idea? No, it is both, and both elements are indispensable. There's no question that someone in the world would have invented a transistor radio, even if Ibuka had decided to build the world's fanciest rice cooker. Transistor radios were an inevitable technological progression. But the first transistor radios were nowhere near pocket-sized, and without Ibuka's unexpected idea, his engineers might have stopped pursuing the technology long before it became small enough to be useful. Ibuka inspired years of effort because he came up with an unexpected idea that challenged hundreds of engineers to do their best work. In May 1961, John F. Kennedy gave a speech to a special session of Congress. It was a time when the Cold War dominated global politics. The Cold War allowed for few ways to measure success, to record gains and losses. But in one highly visible field, the United States was clearly lagging behind. That field was space. 4 years earlier, the United States, which had prided itself as the most technologically advanced nation, was stunned when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, the first satellite. The United States eventually responded with its own satellite launches, but the Soviet Union maintained its lead, racking up first after first. In April 1961, Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first human in space. U.S. astronaut Alan Shepard followed a month later. In Kennedy's address to Congress, he outlined a series of requests to help the United States maintain its leadership during the Cold War. He asked for funds to achieve a number of strategic goals. To establish the AID program for international development. To expand the NATO alliance. To build radio and television stations in Latin America and Southeast Asia. And to shore up civil defense. But he ended the speech on a curious note. His final proposal had nothing to do with international aid or civil defense. It was this. I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. If we make this judgment affirmatively, it will not be one man going to the moon, it will be an entire nation, for all of us must work to put him there. Two unexpected ideas. Both create surprise. Radios are pieces of furniture, not something to slip into a pocket. Men don't walk on the moon. It's a long way up. The air is thin. Both create insight. Rather than leading us along a plodding route from one incremental step to the next, the ideas give us a sudden, dramatic glimpse of how the world might unfold. And not just how, but why. Both create knowledge gaps. Lowenstein, the author of Gap Theory, says it's important to remember that knowledge gaps are painful. If people like curiosity, why do they work to resolve it? He asks. Why don't they put mystery novels down before the last chapter or turn off the television before the final inning of a close ball game? Both of these unexpected ideas set up big knowledge gaps, but not so big that they seemed insurmountable. Kennedy didn't propose a man on Mercury, and Ibuka didn't propose an implantable radio. Each goal was audacious and provocative, but not paralyzing. Any engineer who heard the man on the moon speech must have begun brainstorming immediately. Well, first we'd need to solve this problem, then we'd need to develop this technology, and then... The vision of a pocketable radio sustained a company through a tricky period of growth and led it to become an internationally recognized player in technology. The vision of a man on the moon sustained tens of thousands of separate individuals in dozens of organizations for almost a decade. These are big, powerful, sticky ideas. When we're skeptical about our ability to get people's attention, or our ability to keep people's attention, we should draw inspiration from Kennedy and Ibuka. And, on a smaller scale, from Nora Ephron's journalism teacher and Nordstrom's managers. Unexpectedness in the service of core principles can have surprising longevity. Chapter 3. Concrete. One hot summer day, a fox was strolling through an orchard. He saw a bunch of grapes ripening high on a grapevine. "Just the thing to quench my thirst," he said. Backing up a few paces, he took a run and jumped at the grapes, just missing. Turning around again, he ran faster and jumped again, still amiss. Again and again he jumped, until at last he gave up out of exhaustion. Walking away with his nose in the air, he said, "I am sure they are sour." It's easy to despise what you can't get. The fable above, The Fox and the Grapes, was written by Aesop. According to Herodotus, he was a slave, though he was later freed. Aesop authored some of the stickiest stories in world history. We've all heard his greatest hits, The Tortoise and the Hare, The Boy Who Cried Wolf, The Goose That Laid the Golden Eggs, The Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, and many more. If any story told in this book is still circulating a few millennia from now, odds are it will be The Fox and the Grapes. Even English speakers who've never heard The Fox and the Grapes will recognize the phrase sour grapes, which encapsulates the moral of the story. Aesop's lessons have traveled around the world. In Hungary, people say svanyo szolo, sour grapes, in Hungarian. In China, they say grapes are sour because you cannot reach them. In Sweden, a little local color was added. The Swedish expression surtsaraven om rånbären means sour, the fox said, about the rowan berries. Clearly, Aesop was illustrating a universal human shortcoming. The fable would not have survived for more than 2,500 years if it didn't reflect some profound truth about human nature. But there are many profound truths that have not seeped into the day-to-day language and thinking of dozens of cultures. This truth is especially sticky because of the way it was encoded. The concrete images evoked by the fable, the grapes, the fox, the dismissive comment about sour grapes, allowed its message to persist. One suspects that the lifespan of Aesop's ideas would have been shorter if they'd been encoded as Aesop's helpful suggestions. Don't be such a bitter jerk when you fail. What the world needs is a lot more fables. On the web, a satirical site features a business buzzword generator. Readers can produce their own business buzzwords by combining one word from each of three columns, which yields phrases like reciprocal cost-based re-engineering, customer-oriented visionary paradigm, and strategic logistical values. All of these sound eerily plausible as buzzwords, by the way. Teachers have their own buzzwords. Metacognitive skills, intrinsic motivation, portfolio assessment, developmentally appropriate, thematic learning. And if you've ever talked to a doctor, you don't even have to provide examples. Our favorite from medicine idiopathic cardiomyopathy. Cardiomyopathy means something is wrong with your heart, and idiopathic means we have no idea why yours isn't working. Language is often abstract, but life is not abstract. Teachers teach students about battles and animals in books. Doctors repair problems with our stomachs, backs, and hearts. Companies create software, build planes, distribute newspapers. They build cars that are cheaper, faster, or fancier than last year's. Even the most abstract business strategy must eventually show up in the tangible actions of human beings. It's easier to understand those tangible actions than to understand an abstract strategy statement, just as it's easier to understand a fox dissing some grapes than an abstract commentary about the human psyche. Abstraction makes it harder to understand an idea and to remember it. It also makes it harder to coordinate our activities with others, who may interpret the abstraction in very different ways. Concreteness helps us avoid these problems. This is perhaps the most important lesson that Aesop can teach us. The Nature Conservancy. For 50 years, the Nature Conservancy, TNC, has helped protect environmentally precious areas in the world by using the simplest possible method. It buys them. It buys land at market prices, making it off-limits to environmentally damaging uses, such as development or logging. This strategy has come to be known within TNC as Bucks and Acres. It had appeal to donors and benefactors because the results of their gifts were so clear. A big gift bought a big piece of land. A small gift bought a small piece of land. As one donor commented, TNC produced results you could walk around on. In 2002, Mike Sweeney, the COO of TNC California, was facing a big challenge. California is particularly important to TNC because it contains so many environmentally critical areas. California is one of only 5 Mediterranean climate regions in the world. The others are the Fynbos of South Africa, the Matorral of Chile, the Kwangan of Australia, and of course the Mediterranean. These Mediterranean climate zones occupy only 2% of the world's landmass, but host more than 20% of its plant species. If you want to buy environmentally precious land, Mediterranean climates give you a lot of bang for your buck. In 2002, Sweeney and his staff had taken a map of California and colored in the most environmentally sensitive areas, the areas worth preserving. Astonishingly, 40% of the map was colored. This was a non-starter. There weren't enough bucks out there to buy that many acres. Yet 9% of the state was classified as being in critical danger. 9% of California was still far too much to contemplate purchasing. But these regions were environmentally essential. TNC couldn't simply give up on them. TNC decided to implement some new approaches. Bucks and Acres couldn't succeed with this vast quantity of land. So instead of owning the land outright, TNC would ensure that the critical areas were protected against damage. The organization would pay landowners not to develop their land, buying what's known as a conservation easement. It would work with local and state governments to change policies and encourage conservation of private and public land. It would focus on important marine areas where there was no land to buy. These new strategies made sense. TNC could protect more areas than it could reach through Bucks and Acres, but they also had drawbacks. First, they were much less concrete to donors. Donors can't walk around on a favorable government regulation. Second, they were also potentially demoralizing for employees. They made progress less tangible. When TNC was focused on land deals, Sweeney said, it was easy to celebrate a deal closing, to tell everyone, John and Mary got this land, and to pat them on the back. These milestone moments, so great for morale, were harder to find in the new model. How could TNC make the new strategy more concrete? What would you do in this situation? Is there a way to recapture the invaluable tangibility of the Bucks and Acres strategy in a context that was necessarily more ambiguous? You've got 40%, or at least 9%, of the state to protect. and you can't buy it. How do you explain yourself to donors and partners? Chip has discussed this case with his students at Stanford, and in grappling with the need for concreteness, some students respond by breaking up the impossibly large scale of the challenge. 40% of California, 9% in critical need. By subdividing it into more tangible sub-goals. For example, we will protect a 2% chunk of California every year for 20 years. Others try to invoke a unit of measurement that we can understand, such as the acre. Most people can visualize an acre, but the scale is too big. 2% of California is about 2 million acres. No one can picture 2 million acres. The students are wisely trying to find a way to break up a big abstract goal into smaller, more concrete sub-goals. This is the right idea. But in this case, the numbers are just too big, and acreage is not necessarily the best way to think. There are 1,500-acre plots of land that are more environmentally precious than other 90,000-acre plots. Thinking about acreage per year is akin to a museum curator thinking about canvases per year, without regard to period, style, or painter. Here's what TNC did. Instead of talking in terms of land area, it talked about a landscape. A landscape is a contiguous plot of land with unique environmentally precious features. The TNC set a goal of preserving 50 landscapes, of which 25 were an immediate priority over a 10-year period. 5 landscapes per year sounds more realistic than 2 million acres per year, and it's much more concrete. To the east of Silicon Valley, there is a set of brown hills that are the beginnings of a wilderness the size of Yosemite. The brown hills are an important watershed for the San Francisco Bay, but they are quickly being chipped away by Silicon Valley sprawl. Although the area is important ecologically, it is not like the redwoods or the coast, with beautiful visuals that engage people's imaginations. The hills are covered with grass interspersed with a few oak trees. Most of the year, the grass is brown. Sweeney admits that it's not very sexy. Even local groups in the Silicon Valley area that were interested in protecting open spaces weren't paying attention to the brown hills. But, says Sweeney, we don't go after stuff because it's pretty. We go after it because it's an ecologically important part of creation. TNC named the Oak Savannah the Mount Hamilton Wilderness, based on its highest peak, the site of a local observatory. Identifying the area as a coherent landscape and naming it put it on the map for local groups and policymakers. Before, Sweeney says, Silicon Valley groups wanted to protect important areas close to their homes, but they didn't know where to start. If you say, there's a really important area to the east of Silicon Valley, it's just not exciting because it's not tangible. But when you say the Mount Hamilton Wilderness, their interest perks up. The Packard Foundation, a Silicon Valley institution created by one of the founders of the Hewlett-Packard Company, provided a large grant to protect the Mount Hamilton Wilderness. Other environmental groups in the Bay Area started campaigning to preserve the area. Sweeney says, we're always laughing now because we see other people's documents and they're talking about the Mount Hamilton Wilderness. We say, you know, we made that up. People who live in cities tend to name and define their neighborhoods. The Castro, Soho, Lincoln Park, and so forth. These names come to define an area and its traits. Neighborhoods have personalities. The Nature Conservancy created the same effect with its landscapes. The Mount Hamilton Wilderness is not a set of acres. It's an eco-celebrity. This is not a story about land. It's a story about abstraction. TNC avoided the trap of abstraction, saving 2 million acres per year, by converting abstract blobs on a map into tangible landscapes. TNC realized wisely that the context had grown more ambiguous and the solutions had grown more ambiguous, but that their messages could not be allowed to grow more ambiguous. Concreteness is an indispensable component of sticky ideas. Understanding subtraction. What makes something concrete? If you can examine something with your senses, it's concrete. A V8 engine is concrete. High performance is abstract. Most of the time, concreteness boils down to specific people doing specific things. In the unexpected chapter, we talked about Nordstrom's world-class customer service. World-class customer service is abstract. A Nordy ironing a customer's shirt is concrete. Concrete language helps people, especially novices, understand new concepts. Abstraction is the luxury of the expert. If you got to teach an idea to a room full of people, and you aren't certain what they know, concreteness is the only safe language. To see this, we can start by studying math classrooms in Asia. We know from the news over the years that East Asian children outperform American children in, well, just about everything except the consumption of fatty foods. This is especially evident in math. The math skills of Americans fall behind those of Asians early. The gap is apparent in the first grade, and it widens throughout elementary school. What are Asian schools doing differently? Our stereotype is that these schools operate with almost robotic efficiency. Hours are long and discipline is strict. We think of East Asian students as being less creative somehow. We like to think they outperform our students through rote mechanics and memorization. The truth, it turns out, is almost exactly the opposite. In 1993, a group of researchers studied 10 schools in Japan, 10 in Taiwan, and 20 in the United States. In each school, they picked two different math teachers to observe, and they observed four lessons with each teacher. The researchers found that all the teachers used rote recall quite a bit. It was standard procedure in at least half the lessons observed in every country. But other techniques varied greatly among the three countries. For instance, consider this question by a Japanese teacher. You had 100 yen, but then you bought a notebook for 70 yen. How much money do you still have? Or this question, posed by a teacher in Taiwan. Originally, there are three kids playing ball. Two more came later, and then one more joined them. How many are playing now? As she talked, she drew stick figures on the board and wrote down the equation, 3 + 2 + 1. Notice that these teachers are explaining abstract mathematical concepts by emphasizing things that are concrete and familiar, buying school supplies and playing ball. Their explanations take advantage of pre-existing schemas, a tactic we explored in the simple chapter. Teachers take an existing schema, the dynamics of a six-person ball game, and overlay a new layer of abstraction. The researchers called this style of questioning computing in context. It is pretty much the opposite of rote recall. And, contrary to our stereotypes, it occurred about twice as much in Asia as it did in the United States. 61% of lessons versus 31%. In another case, a Japanese teacher placed on a desk 5 rows of 10 tiles each. Then she took away 3 rows of 10 tiles. She asked the student how many tiles were left, and he gave the correct answer, 20. The teacher then asked the students how they knew that this was a subtraction problem. This teacher provided her students with a visual image of subtraction. Students could build an abstract concept, subtraction, on a concrete foundation. 30 tiles being yanked away from an original set of 50. The researchers coded questions like this one as conceptual knowledge questions. This type of question was asked in 37% of lessons in Japan, 20% in Taiwan, but only 2% in the United States. Using concreteness as a foundation for abstraction is not just good for mathematical instruction. It is a basic principle of understanding. Novices crave concreteness. Have you ever read an academic paper or a technical article or even a memo and found yourself so flummoxed by the fancy abstract language that you were crying out for an example? Or maybe you've experienced the frustration of cooking from a recipe that was too abstract. Cook until the mixture reaches a hearty consistency. Huh? Just tell me how many minutes to stir. Show me a picture of what it looks like. After we've cooked the dish a few times, then the phrase, hearty consistency, might start to make sense. we build a sensory image of what that phrase represents. But the first time, it's as meaningless as 3 plus 2 plus 1 would be to a 3-year-old. This is how concreteness helps us understand. It helps us construct higher, more abstract insights on the building blocks of our existing knowledge and perceptions. Abstraction demands some concrete foundation. Trying to teach an abstract principle without concrete foundations is like trying to start a house by building a roof in the air. Concrete is memorable. Concrete ideas are easier to remember. Take individual words, for instance. Experiments in human memory have shown that people are better at remembering concrete, easily visualized nouns, bicycle or avocado, than abstract ones, justice or personality. Naturally, sticky ideas are stuffed full of concrete words and images. Think of the Kentucky Fried Rat or the Kidney Heist's ice-filled bathtub. The Kidney Heist legend would have been far less sticky if the man had woken up and found that someone had absconded with his self-esteem. Yale researcher Eric Havelock studies tales that have been passed down by word of mouth, such as the Iliad and the Odyssey. He notes that these tales are characterized by lots of concrete actions, with few abstractions. Why? The ancient Greeks certainly had no problem with abstraction. This was the society that produced Plato and Aristotle, after all. Havelock believes that the stories evolved away from abstraction over time. When they were passed along from generation to generation, the more memorable concrete details survived and the abstractions evaporated. Let's skip to the modern world and another timeless and beautiful domain of expression, accounting. Put yourself in the shoes of an accounting professor who has to introduce accounting principles to college students. To a new student, accounting can seem bewilderingly abstract. The income statement, the balance sheet, T accounts, accounts receivable, treasury stock. No people or sensory data in sight. As the teacher, how do you make accounting concepts vivid? Two professors from Georgia State University, Carol Springer and Faye Borthwick, decided to try something radically different. In the fall of 2000, Springer and Borthwick taught a semester of accounting using as a centerpiece a semester-long case study. The case study followed a new business launched by two imaginary college sophomores, Chris and Sandy, at LeGrand State University. Chris and Sandy had an idea for a new product called Safe Night Out, SNO, a device targeted at parents with teenagers who were old enough to drive. Installed in the teenager's car, the device would record the route and speed of the car. For the first time, parents could confirm whether their car was being driven responsibly. At this point, you, as a student in introductory accounting, become part of the story. Chris and Sandy are your friends, and they've heard that you're taking an accounting class. They need your help. They ask, "Is our business idea feasible? How many units would we have to sell in order to pay for our tuition?" You are given guidance on how to track down the costs of the relevant materials. GPS receivers, storage hardware, and partnerships. How much it would cost to sell it on eBay. The semester-long Chris and Sandy soap opera revealed the role that accounting plays in business life. Every accounting course defines the distinction between fixed and variable costs. But in the soap opera, this distinction wasn't so much defined as discovered. Chris and Sandy have to pay some costs, no matter what, such as the programming expense for developing the product. Those are fixed costs. Other costs are incurred only when products are made or sold. The cost of the materials, or eBay's commission, for example. Those are variable costs. If your friends are pouring their tuition money into a startup business, those distinctions matter. The case study is an example of learning in context, similar to the teachers in the Asian math classrooms. But in the math classrooms, a student might encounter 300 different examples over the course of a semester. In the accounting class, students had one example that was sufficiently rich to encompass a semester's worth of material. As the semester progresses, you witness from your hot seat, as Chris and Sandy's accountant, the evolution of their business. A local court approaches Chris and Sandy, wanting to use the SNO device for its parolees, but it wants to lease the device rather than buy it. How should Chris and Sandy respond? Later, the business begins to grow rapidly, but suddenly, Chris and Sandy make a panicked call to you, having bounced a check. They've been selling more units than ever, yet there's no cash in the bank. How is that possible? This problem is faced by many startup businesses, and it introduces the difference between profitability and cash flow. The answer becomes clear to you only after you've worked through a month of payment slips and eBay receipts. So, did the students learn better? At first, it was hard to say. The changes to the course made it hard to compare final exams directly with those of previous years. Some students seemed more enthusiastic about the new course, but others groused because the case study demanded a lot of time. Over time, however, the benefits of the concrete case study became increasingly obvious. After experiencing the case study, students with high GPAs were more likely to major in accounting. The concreteness actually made the most capable students want to become accountants. But the case study also had positive effects for regular students. In the next accounting course, taken an average of 2 years later, the first section of the course built heavily on the concepts that students were supposed to have learned in introductory accounting. Students who had worked through the case study scored noticeably higher on this first exam. In fact, the difference in scores was particularly dramatic for students with a C average overall. Generally speaking, they scored 12 points higher, and remember, this is 2 years after the case study ended. Concreteness sticks. The Velcro Theory of Memory. What is it about concreteness that makes ideas stick? The answer lies with the nature of our memories. Many of us have a sense that remembering something is a bit like putting it in storage. To remember a story is to file it away in our cerebral filing cabinets. There's nothing wrong with that analogy. But the surprising thing is that there may be completely different filing cabinets for different kinds of memories. You can actually test this idea for yourself. The following set of sentences will ask you to remember various ideas. Spend 5 or 10 seconds lingering on each one. Don't rush through them. As you move from one sentence to another, you'll notice that it feels different to remember different kinds of things. Remember the capital of Kansas. Remember the first line of Hey Jude or some other song that you know well. Remember the Mona Lisa. Remember the house where you spent most of your childhood. Remember the definition of truth. Remember the definition of watermelon. David Rubin, a cognitive psychologist at Duke University, uses this exercise to illustrate the nature of memory. Each command to remember seems to trigger a different mental activity. Remembering the capital of Kansas is an abstract exercise unless you happen to live in Topeka. By contrast, when you think about Hey Jude, you may hear Paul McCartney's voice and piano playing. If the phrase Hey Jude drew a blank, please exchange this book for a Beatles album. You'll be happier. No doubt the Mona Lisa memory conjured a visual image of that famously enigmatic smile. Remembering your childhood home might have evoked a host of memories, smells, sounds, sights. You might even have felt yourself running through your home or remembering where your parents used to sit. The definition of truth may have been a bit harder to summon. You certainly have a sense of what truth means, but you probably had no pre-formulated definition to pluck out of memory, as with the Mona Lisa. You might have had to create a definition on the fly that seemed to fit with your sense of what truth means. The definition of watermelon might also have involved some mental gyrations. The word watermelon immediately evoked sense memories. The striped green rind and red fruit, the sweet smell and taste, the heft of a whole watermelon. Then you might have felt your gears switch as you tried to encapsulate these sense memories into a definition. Memory, then, is not like a single filing cabinet. It is more like Velcro. If you look at the two sides of Velcro material, you'll see that one is covered with thousands of tiny hooks, and the other is covered with thousands of tiny loops. When you press the two sides together, a huge number of hooks get snagged inside the loops, and that's what causes Velcro to seal. Your brain hosts a truly staggering number of loops. The more hooks an idea has, the better it will cling to memory. Your childhood home has a gazillion hooks in your brain. A new credit card number has one if it's lucky. Great teachers have a knack for multiplying the hooks in a particular idea. A teacher from Iowa named Jane Elliott once designed a message so powerful, tapping into so many different aspects of emotion and memory, that 20 years later, her students still remember it vividly. Brown eyes, blue eyes. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on April 4, 1968. The next day, Jane Elliott, an elementary school teacher in Iowa, found herself trying to explain his death to her classroom of third graders. In the all-white town of Riceville, Iowa, students were familiar with King, but could not understand who would want him dead or why. Elliott said, "I knew it was time to deal with this in a concrete way, because we'd talked about discrimination since the first day of school. But the shooting of Martin Luther King, one of our heroes of the month, 2 months earlier, couldn't be explained to little third graders in Riceville, Iowa." She came to class the next day with a plan. She aimed to make prejudice tangible to her students. At the start of the class, she divided the students into two groups, brown-eyed kids and blue-eyed kids. She then made a shocking announcement. Brown-eyed kids were superior to blue-eyed kids. They're the better people in this room. The groups were separated. Blue-eyed kids were forced to sit at the back of the classroom. Brown-eyed kids were told that they were smarter. They were given extra time at recess. The blue-eyed kids had to wear special collars so that everyone would know their eye color from a distance. The two groups were not allowed to mix at recess. Elliott was shocked at how quickly the class was transformed. "I watched those kids turn into nasty, vicious, discriminating third graders. It was ghastly," she said. Friendships seemed to dissolve instantly as brown-eyed kids taunted their blue-eyed former friends. One brown-eyed student asked Elliott how she could be the teacher, "if you've got dem blue eyes." At the start of class the following day, Elliott walked in and announced that she had been wrong. It was actually the brown-eyed children who were inferior. This reversal of fortune was embraced instantly. A shout of glee went up from the blue-eyed kids as they ran to place their collars on their lesser brown-eyed counterparts. On the day when they were in the inferior group, students described themselves as sad, bad, stupid, and mean. "When we were down," one boy said, his voice cracking, "it felt like everything bad was happening to us. When they were on top, the students felt happy, good, and smart." Even their performance on academic tasks changed. One of the reading exercises was the phonics card pack that the kids were supposed to go through as quickly as possible. The first day, when the blue-eyed kids were on the bottom, it took them 5.5 minutes. On the second day, when they were on top, it took 2.5 minutes. "Why couldn't you go this fast yesterday?" Elliott asked. One blue-eyed girl said, "We had those collars on." Another student chimed in, "We couldn't stop thinking about those collars." Elliott's simulation made prejudice concrete, brutally concrete. It also had an enduring impact on the students' lives. Studies conducted 10 and 20 years later showed that Elliott's students were significantly less prejudiced than their peers who had not been through the exercise. Students still remember the simulation vividly. A 15-year reunion of Elliott's students broadcast on the PBS series Frontline revealed how deeply it had moved them. Ray Hansen, remembering the way his understanding changed from one day to the next, said, "It was one of the most profound learning experiences I've ever had." Suginder Rollins said, "Prejudice has to be worked out young, or it will be with you all your life. Sometimes I catch myself discriminating, stop myself, think back to the third grade, and remember what it was like to be put down. Jane Elliott put hooks into the idea of prejudice. It would have been easy for her to treat the idea of prejudice the way other classroom ideas are treated, as an important but abstract bit of knowledge like the capital of Kansas or the definition of truth. She could have treated prejudice as something to be learned, like the story of a World War II battle. Instead, Elliott turned prejudice into an experience. Think of the hooks involved. The sight of a friend suddenly sneering at you. The feel of a collar around your neck. The despair at feeling inferior. The shock you get when you look at your own eyes in the mirror. This experience put so many hooks into the students' memories that decades later, it could not be forgotten. The Path to Abstraction, the Blueprint, and the Machine. Jane Elliott's simulation of prejudice is compelling evidence of the power of concreteness. But if concreteness is so powerful, why do we slip so easily into abstraction? The reason is simple. Because the difference between an expert and a novice is the ability to think abstractly. New jurors are struck by lawyers' personalities and factual details and courtroom rituals. Meanwhile, judges weigh the current case against the abstract lessons of past cases and legal precedent. Biology students try to remember whether reptiles lay eggs or not. Biology teachers think in terms of the grand system of animal taxonomy. Novices perceive concrete details as concrete details. Experts perceive concrete details as symbols of patterns and insights that they have learned through years of experience. And because they are capable of seeing a higher level of insight, they naturally want to talk on a higher level. They want to talk about chess strategies, not about bishops moving diagonally. And here is where our classic villain, the curse of knowledge, inserts itself. A researcher named Beth Betschke studied a manufacturing firm that designed and built the complicated machinery used to produce silicon chips. To build such machinery, the firm needed two sets of skills: engineers who could create brilliant designs, and skilled manufacturing people who could transform those designs into complex physical machines. If the firm was to succeed, these two sets of people had to be able to communicate smoothly. But not surprisingly, they spoke different languages. The engineers tended to think abstractly. They spent their day agonizing over drawings and blueprints. The manufacturing team, on the other hand, tended to think on a physical level. They spent their day building machines. What's most revealing for the curse of knowledge is what happened when something went wrong in the manufacturing floor. The manufacturing folks would sometimes run into a problem. Something didn't fit, or perhaps wasn't receiving enough power. The manufacturers would bring the problem to the engineers, and the engineers would immediately get to work. Specifically, they'd get to work fixing their drawings. For example, the manufacturing team might find a part that didn't fit on the machine. When the team showed the part to the engineers, they wanted to pull out the blueprints and move things around on the drawing. In other words, the engineers instinctively wanted to jump to a higher level of abstraction. The engineers, Betschke found, made their drawings increasingly elaborate in the hope that the enhanced drawings would clarify the process for the manufacturers. Over time, the drawings became more abstract, which further hampered communication. The engineers were behaving like American tourists who travel to foreign countries and try to make themselves understood by speaking English more slowly and loudly. They were suffering from the curse of knowledge. They had lost the ability to imagine what it was like to look at a technical drawing from the perspective of a non-expert. The manufacturing people were thinking, "Why don't you just come down to the factory floor and show me where the parts should go?" And the engineering people were thinking, "What do I need to do to make the drawings better?" The miscommunication has a quality that is familiar, no doubt, to many readers who don't work on silicon chip-making machinery. So, how do you fix it? Should both parties learn greater empathy for the other and, in essence, meet in the middle? Actually, no. The solution is for the engineers to change their behavior. Why? As Betschke notes, the physical machine was the most effective and relevant domain of communication. Everyone understands the machines fluently. Therefore, problems should be solved at the level of the machine. It's easy to lose awareness that we're talking like an expert. We start to suffer from the curse of knowledge, like the tappers in the Tappers and Listeners game. It can feel unnatural to speak concretely about subject matter we've known intimately for years. But if we're willing to make the effort, we'll see the rewards. Our audience will understand what we're saying and remember it. The moral of this story is not to dumb things down. The manufacturing people faced complex problems and they needed smart answers. Rather, the moral of the story is to find a universal language, one that everyone speaks fluently. Inevitably, that universal language will be concrete. Concrete allows coordination. In the last chapter, we close with two unexpected slogans that were used to motivate and coordinate large groups of smart people. The slogans were challenges to build a pocketable radio and to put a man on the moon within the decade. Notice that these slogans are also pleasingly concrete. It is doubtful that Japanese engineers were paralyzed with uncertainty about their mission, or that much time was spent at NASA quibbling about the meaning of man, moon, or decade. Concreteness makes targets transparent. Even experts need transparency. Consider a software startup whose goal is to build the next great search engine. Within the startup are two programmers with nearly identical knowledge working in neighboring cubes. To one, the next great search engine means completeness, ensuring that the search engine returns everything on the web that might be relevant, no matter how obscure. To the other, it means speed, ensuring pretty good results very fast. Their efforts will not be fully aligned until the goal is made concrete. When Boeing prepared to launch the design of the 727 passenger plane in the 1960s, its managers set a goal that was deliberately concrete. The 727 must seat 131 passengers, fly nonstop from Miami to New York City, and land on runway 4-22 at LaGuardia. The 4-22 runway was chosen for its length, less than a mile, which was much too short for any of the existing passenger jets. With a goal this concrete, Boeing effectively coordinated the actions of thousands of experts in various aspects of engineering or manufacturing. Imagine how much harder it would have been to build a 727 whose goal was to be the best passenger plane in the world. The Ferraris go to Disney World in the R&D lab. Stone Yamashita Partners, a small consulting firm in San Francisco, was founded by Robert Stone and Keith Yamashita, former Apple creatives. Stone Yamashita is a master of using concrete techniques to help organizations create change. "Almost everything we do is visceral and visual," Keith Yamashita says. "The product of most consulting firms is often a PowerPoint presentation. At Stone Yamashita, it's much more likely to be a simulation, an event, or a creative installation." Around 2002, Stone Yamashita was approached by Hewlett-Packard, HP. HP's top management team hoped to win a partnership with Disney, and they asked Stone Yamashita to help prepare a proposal that would highlight HP research and show how it could help Disney run its theme parks. HP, like many technology firms, generates great research in its laboratories, but that research isn't always translated into tangible physical products. Researchers get excited about pushing the boundaries of a technology, making products that are complex and sophisticated, while customers generally seek out products that are easy and reliable. The desires of researchers and customers don't always dovetail. The presentation that Stone Yamashita designed was an exhibit that filled 6,000 square feet. Yamashita describes the gist. "We invented a fictitious family called the Ferraris. Three generations of them, and built an exhibit around their life and their visit to Disney World. Walking into the exhibit, you begin in the Ferrari's living room, furnished with family photos. Each subsequent room followed the Ferraris through various scenes of their Disney World vacation. HP Technology helped them buy tickets, spread their entry into the